Today is Sunday, 9th November 2025, and let me remind you again before I proceed with this program to tick the like button if once you've seen and listened to this program, you've decided that you've liked this program or whatever part of the program you've chosen to watch and decide that you wish to indicate that fact. Now, today's programme will be devoted almost entirely to the situation in Ukraine, though I do want to say something about the situation in Venezuela before this programme ends. But let me first of all begin by returning to a topic that I discussed in my programme yesterday, and that is the enormous, massive Russian missile and drone attack, which I spoke about yesterday, but which took place the night before. And I think it has now become clear that this was perhaps the single most devastating attack the Russians have launched against Ukraine's energy system up to this point. According to the Ukrainians, something like 500 drones and missiles were launched in total. Mostly these targeted, as far as I can tell, energy installations. The Ukrainians claim that the bulk of the missiles that the Russians launched were ground-based Iskander ballistic missiles. The Russians themselves say that they launched Kinjal's hypersonic missiles, which of course air-launched from MiG-31 fighter jets. And apparently the Russian Navy, the Black Sea Fleet, was also involved, and some Kalibr subsonic cruise missiles were also launched. But mostly, according to the Ukrainians, the bulk of the missiles were ground-launched. And this is becoming, by the way, a characteristic development in this war. The Russians have apparently come to the decision that the most effective way to attack Ukraine today, in terms of missile launches, is with ground-launched missiles. And I think there is actually a very simple reason for this. When Russian bombers take off from their air bases, the fact is monitored by Western intelligence agencies. They then advise the Ukrainians that these bombers have taken off, and the Ukrainians apparently have something like 3 hours warning before the subsonic cruise missiles arrive. When Russia launches ground-based ballistic missiles, by contrast, there is scarcely any warning at all. And the same is true of Kinjal missiles. The MiG-31s themselves are high supersonic aircraft. They can apparently, in a clean condition, operate at around three times the speed of sound. But when they're carrying missiles, they obviously operate at lower speeds. But anyway, they can take off, fly to their positions very fast, and then of course once the hypersonic missiles are launched, they reach their targets in just a few minutes. So again, there is hardly any warning provided. And what has, I suspect, up to now held the Russians back from operating, conducting these strikes mostly with Iskander missiles, the reason why they have up to now been deploying bombers and subsonic cruise missiles launched from bombers mostly in their strikes is because there simply haven't been enough Iskander ballistic missiles. These are large, complex rocket missiles. They take time to build up, and presumably the production of these Iskander missiles is now large enough that the Russians can conduct strikes using them against Ukrainian targets. Anyway, the long and the short of it is that the Ukrainians again claim that there were about 450 drones, mostly Garand drones, involved in this strike. They claim to have shot down around 400 of them. Who's to say? I don't think that's very likely myself. But their success rate in shooting down ballistic missiles and hypersonic missiles is, as they themselves acknowledge, very, very much lower. And I'm going to suggest even lower than the Ukrainians themselves say. For the record, though the Ukrainians have at many occasions claimed success in shooting down Kinjal hypersonic missiles, the Russians categorically deny that that is the case and insist that in every case, hypersonic missiles, Kinjal missiles, once they have been launched, have managed to hit the targets. Anyway, this is what the Russians are saying, that there was, the Ukrainians are saying that there was a mix of different types of missiles used, but mostly these were ballistic missiles, Iskander missiles, and hypersonic missiles rather than cruise missiles. Regardless, it is clear that most of the missiles did hit their targets, even the Ukrainians acknowledge this, and the results in general have been devastating. Yesterday, the Ukrainian energy authorities were saying that all Ukraine's thermal power plants were out of action. There are harrowing pictures and films of one of these power stations with smoke rising from it in various locations, again suggesting very extensive damage. There are pictures of the city of Kiev plunged in darkness and with the only lights coming from passing passenger cars. There were reports yesterday that the most of the cities, many of the cities in across Ukraine, were suffering blackouts. And the Ukrainian authorities were saying that the time necessary to repair the damage and to restore power would be considerable. And even just before I started making this program, there was another comment by the Ukrainians saying that despite the fact that some power has been restored in some places, and though repairs are still underway, the extent of the damage makes restoration of power complicated. Now, the Ukrainian foreign minister, Mr. Sibiga, is also alleging that the Russians attacked two nuclear power substations, two substations, electricity substations, attached to nuclear power plants. The implication, I suppose, being that the Russians were seeking to reduce electricity flow to the nuclear power stations, which would, of course, make their operation impractical or perhaps dangerous. Now, as at the time of making this program, I have seen no confirmation of that or denial of that either from any Russian source. This is a claim made by the Ukrainian foreign minister. The Russians up to now have consistently avoided attacking the nuclear power plants or facilities that are connected to them. I don't myself believe that that has changed. But we will no doubt learn more about that over the next couple of days. I suspect that this is again an attempt by the Ukrainian foreign minister to rally international support for Ukraine at this time. He particularly mentioned Ukraine needing support from India and China, in which case, if the actual information he has provided is untrue, Well, perhaps what his comment does is highlight further the disastrous situation with the Ukrainian energy system that Ukraine is now facing, that they're doing everything they can and saying whatever they can in order to get international support. Having said that, I want to make it clear that I don't know whether or not this allegation is true or untrue. I am guessing that it is untrue based on previous Russian behavior. If the Russians are indeed now attacking substations connected to nuclear power plants, then that is a major escalation and perhaps a further sign that events in Ukraine are coming to a head and that the major Russian offensive is about to begin. The major, big, perhaps final Russian offensive is about to begin. Anyway, let's discuss briefly some of the comments that have been made about this attack. There is much discussion and speculation about what the Russians are trying to do as a result of these attacks. I mean, are they trying to knock out the entire energy system? And by the way, I should also say the internet system, the Ukrainian internet, which is also badly affected yesterday. Well, are they trying to completely disable these systems in a way that would cause a humanitarian disaster in Ukraine? Or are they instead, as various reports say, mostly on the Russian side of the internet, are they trying to reduce the Ukrainian energy system to a crisis level, deepening the sense of crisis and tension within Ukrainian society, obliging Ukraine to divert resources to deal with the problems caused by the attack on the energy system, and to worry about what that means? Are they going to do all of those things except and then hang back from its total destruction at the very last point? Well, I think the most plausible explanation about what the Russians are trying to do is one given 2 years ago by John Helmer on his blog Dancing with Bears, when he discussed the very first strikes the Russians conducted against the Ukrainian energy system, and said that he'd received advice from an American technician that the Russians were working out all the elements, all the component parts of the Ukrainian energy system ahead of what would be the devastating final strike before the last great offensive, the one that would bring the Russian army all the way to Kiev before that major attack came, the attack which would be intended to paralyze all communication and all transport in Ukraine at the time of that offensive. And I suspect that that remains the case, that the Russians are degrading and weakening the system. By now, they must know how it works very well and how repairs are organized and what resources the Ukrainians have to carry them out. The Russians must know all of that. But they are not going to completely turn it off now until the moment comes when they will launch their final offensive towards Kiev itself, aiming presumably at that point to achieve the removal of the current Ukrainian government, which some Russian officials, Medvedev, for example, and to some extent Lavrov too, have made it fairly obvious that that is what they want to see. So That, I suspect, is what the Russians are trying to do here. They're also, of course, doing something else, which is that they're depleting constantly Ukraine's air defence system. To all intents and purposes, it has proved completely ineffective. Whatever successes the Ukrainians might have had shooting down cruise missiles, subsonic cruise missiles that the Russians were launching, we can clearly see that they're not able to replicate that success against ballistic missiles and hypersonic missiles, all of which, or most of which, appear to be getting through. So, having said that, the Russians will want to keep the Ukrainians and their Western allies trying. They will want Ukraine to continue to deplete its Patriot missile arsenal, such as it is, further, because the Russians will probably, in conjunction with that big ground offensive that I've just been talking about, want to use their air force to conduct strikes on Ukrainian positions ahead of that offensive. And on that point, as I discussed in a program yesterday, the Russian Air Force continues to increase in size. There's been a second batch of Sukhoi 34 fighter bombers supplied to the Russian Air Force. This just after an earlier batch supplied in October. We don't know the size of these batches. Some say that it's as few as two per batch. I think it's four, and I have reasons to think that, but I'm not going to discuss that in these programs. Anyway, the Russians increasing the number of their fighter bombers and also increasing the number of their FAB precision-guided bombs. And as I discussed in a recent program, they've now installed jet engines on some of these bombs, which has very considerably increased the range at which these particular bombs can now be used. So anyway, a major attack on Ukraine by the Russians, perhaps the most devastating attack up to now. Now, before I stop discussing the attack itself, let me just say that, of course, the Russians do give their own explanation, their own reasons for these attacks. They say that they conduct these attacks on the Ukrainian energy system in retaliation for Ukraine's attacks on Russia's energy system. The refineries, the power stations, these attacks that Ukraine regularly tries to carry out using its own small homemade drones. I have to say straight away that I do not believe that explanation. It seems to me that the Russian offensive against the Ukrainian energy system began in autumn of 2022, long before the Ukrainians were able to conduct strikes against Russia's energy system. Just saying. There is also such a massive imbalance in terms of the damage done. The Russian strikes have managed to knock out pretty much the entire power supply across Ukraine, or at least enough of it to cause blackouts right across the whole country and in all major Ukrainian cities. The Ukrainian attacks, by contrast, have achieved at most brief interruptions of power in a tiny number of Russian cities and apparently briefly in one of the micro districts of Moscow. This whole missile offensive gives every indication of having been meticulously and thoroughly planned. I said that the reason the Russians are now using Iskander missiles, ballistic missiles, far more than was true previously, is because they must have ramped up production of these missiles to the point where they can use them in this way. And of course, that must imply, by definition, foreknowledge that they would be used in that way. It is a further example of forward planning. And the Russians, obviously, must be selecting their targets carefully. It seems to me a certainty that each one of these attacks, very sophisticated and complex attacks, using different kinds of missiles, different kinds of launchers, MiG-31 fighter jets, ground launchers, different types of Iskander missiles also, by the way, and all of this coordinated with huge drone attacks as well. All of that suggests that each of these strikes, these big Russian strikes, are meticulously and thoroughly planned in advance, and they're carried out according to these plans. And by the way, the degree of coordination and the degree of control over the drones and the missiles that the Russians are able to show when they conduct these strikes is enormously impressive and on a much, much greater scale than what we used to see when this offensive, this missile offensive first started in the autumn of 2022. So all of that argues to me against these being a lot more than just acts of retaliation. I ought to say that when the Russians first launched their missile strikes in the autumn of 2022 against Ukraine, they argued, they claimed that they were responding to a Ukrainian bombing attack on the Kerch Bridge, the Crimean Bridge. Now, the reason, of course, has changed, but I don't take any of these reasons for retaliation or alleged retaliation at all seriously. This is clearly a planned offensive, meticulously prepared, with the initial planning probably having taken place as long ago as the summer and autumn of 2022. So anyway, there we are. That's this massive Russian attack to which the Ukrainians have no response and the Western powers have no response, which probably explains the complete silence that there is, or not complete, but the overwhelming silence there is about these attacks now. Way back in the spring and early summer, President Trump used to complain about Russian missile strikes on Kiev. He's now choosing to stay silent about them. The media in Britain and in Europe and in the United States too, by the way, hardly covers them anymore, even though these strikes are becoming increasingly more powerful and more devastating. All of this is signs, are clear signs, clear signals that Western governments know that they cannot supply Ukraine with air defense systems to try to counter these missiles and drones, that all attempts to do so have been a failure, that all that they have achieved is to deplete catastrophically the West's own inventories of air defense missiles and to expose their weakness, their inability to counter Russian missile strikes, missile and drone strikes of this kind. So, despite the fact that Ukraine, the country of the West, is still encouraging in its war against Russia, it's still cheering the Ukrainians on, at least the European governments continue to do so, and continue to insist that they are there supporting Ukraine for as long as it takes, even as the lights go dark across Ukraine, even as the Ukrainian civilian population is suffering ever greater privations and must fear the onset of what is apparently threatening to be already a very cold winter. Western governments, Western media are saying as little about this strike and all of the latest strikes that they can. Anyway, that's the situation with this enormous missile strike. The fact that it has taken place, by the way, continues to show that the Russians remain in an implacable mood. Those who still expect that there will be a negotiated settlement of this conflict perhaps ought to notice the fact that the Russian military, at least, is behaving in a way that suggests that they do not expect that to happen. Anyway, that is the missile strike. Now, it would be remiss of me, having started with developments in the war, not to say something about the ground situation as well. And of course, the main story continues to be Pokrovsk. There's been less information from the Russian Defense Ministry about the situation in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk, and indeed across the entire conflict lines over the last 24 hours. And this is actually quite standard because it's the weekend and the Russians generally give less information on the weekend until they provide a comprehensive summary of the events of the entire week, which they will probably do in a few hours. So I don't have much more information about the situation in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk than I did yesterday. But such information that I do have suggests that the situation in both places continues to get more and more critical for the unlucky Ukrainian troops who are trapped in these two towns. So, as I said in my program yesterday, it is now widely acknowledged that the entire Ukrainian force, or what's left of it, that was in Pokrovsk, has now transferred to Mirnograd, so that Pokrovsk is effectively now under Russian control. I have seen footage of Russian military police taking up positions inside various parts of Pokrovsk. They're entering Pokrovsk in motor vehicles, and you can see them setting up checkpoints at various points in the town. All of that consistent with mopping up operations and the Russians now establishing or tightening their control. There are no doubt some Ukrainian troops still isolated from each other in various parts of Pokrovsk, but the Russians will hunt them down, and hopefully they will have the good sense to surrender, in which case they have a high chance of being returned to Ukraine and perhaps even reunited with their families. Anyway, that's Pokrovsk. In Mirnograd, the Russians continue to claim that they are tightening their positions in Mirnograd. They say that they have managed to gain more ground there. One of the Russian commanders who has been providing information to TASS has again spoken of how his troops are advancing on the east bank of the Oskol River. And there are some reports also that the Russians continue to advance on the west bank too. All of the indications, as I said, in Kupiansk, Pokrovsk, continue to speak of Russian advances in both of these places. Now, in Mirnograd, it's been suggested that the total number of Ukrainian troops who are essentially blocked there And when I say blocked in Mirnograd, it's worth saying that now that the Russians control Pokrovsk, the siege of Mirnograd has become even tighter. Anyway, there are reports that the total number of Ukrainian troops holding together in northwest Mirnograd numbers around 2,000. And I think that is a realistic number. The Russians, the Kremlin, Peskov, said some days ago, about 10 days ago, that there were 5,500 Ukrainian troops cut off inside the Pokrovsk cauldron. I'm guessing that that was about correct. Some of these troops will still be in Pokrovsk. Others will be scattered in various other places around the cauldron, including, by the way, in southern Mirnograd and such places. Several hundreds have probably been killed trying to escape or in fighting. I can imagine that that 5,500 has now whittled down to an organized force that numbers just 2,000. And it has been suggested that what the Russians want is for this entire force to lay down its arms and surrender, because that would have, obviously, enormous media advantages for them. Precisely for that reason, of course, Zelensky opposes this. Well, again, we will see what happens. My guess is that at some point over the next couple of days, we will start to see mass surrenders in Pokrovsk and almost certainly in Kupiansk too. So anyway, that's the state of the battle in these two places. Now, there are further reports in other places as well. In Zaporozhye region, the Russians continue their remorseless advance eastwards. As I said in my last program, they've now captured the village of Uspenovka, one of the fortified villages on the Yanchur River. And the encirclement of Gulyapolye now looks to be only perhaps 1 or 2 weeks away, guessing here, but possibly. There has been video footage which shows the Russian ring around Siversk tightening still. There's film footage showing a Russian soldier in action on the very western, on the very eastern outskirts of Siversk itself, which strongly suggests that, as the Russian Defense Ministry claims, fighting is indeed taking place inside Siversk. And the Russians have also apparently established positions just to the south of Siversk as well. So there's probably some kind of fighting, urban fighting, taking place in Siversk too. And there's also reports that the Russians have advanced more deeply to Konstantinovka, and apparently there's video footage of this as well. The Russians continue to be on the offensive right across the entire contact line. I know of nowhere where the Ukrainians are able to attack, and I know of nowhere where the Ukrainians are even mounting successful counterattacks anymore. Now, yesterday in my program, I also discussed certain really extraordinarily different contradictory statements made by the Ukrainian General Staff and by Zelensky himself about the situation in Pokrovsk. The General Staff said that important decisions about Pokrovsk had been made. They would be decided on purely military basis, and they would not be publicized until the consequences of those decisions were made clear. Zelensky, by contrast, insisted that Pakras must be held at all costs. He spoke about the importance of holding on to Pakrovsk because of the terrible effect the fall of Pakrovsk would have on opinion in the West, and in particular on the opinion of one individual. He didn't name him, but it was clear he was thinking about Donald Trump. Now, what I had not realized when I did my program yesterday is that these two divergent statements, the one from the General Staff and the one by Zelensky, were made over the course of a meeting in Kiev at which the chief of the Ukraine's General Staff, General Gnatov, and Zelensky himself were both participating. And given how different these statements are, they suggest that there is a major quarrel, a major argument taking place. As I understand it, Gnatov, on behalf of the Ukrainian General Staff, made the comments that I've discussed previously, the comments about the Ukrainian General Staff making important decisions, the nature of which could not be disclosed and which would only be disclosed once their consequences were known. So that was what Gnatov said, and he said that with Zelensky apparently sitting opposite him. And Zelensky gesticulated and was clearly extremely unhappy. And it was at this point that he rejoined that it was important to hold on to Pakrovsk and to do everything possible to hold on to Pakrovsk, because were Pakrovsk to fall, it would have this potentially very damaging effect on opinion in the West. I can't help but think that what we have seen, what this whole exchange shows, it's a glimpse of a furious row that is taking place between Zelensky and the military behind the scenes. Now, this pitches the Ukrainian General Staff, General Gnatov, against Zelensky and Ukraine's political leadership. I am not sure where this leaves General Zelensky, the overall military commander, whether he was even present at this meeting, what he was doing exactly, and whether he said anything over the course of this meeting, assuming he was even there. But assuming that he was there, it is nonetheless interesting that it is another Ukrainian general, General Gnatov, who appears to be arguing back at Zelensky about the conduct of the war, and is basically telling Zelensky, look, this is a crisis in Pakrovsk. We, the military, are going to have to deal with this. Stop interfering with it. And we are going to tell you what the results of what we're going to do will be once we have done them. I mean, I cannot recall a moment in this war when any Ukrainian general has spoken directly to Zelensky in that way. Now, when General Zaluzhny was the overall military commander in Ukraine, I used to read regularly in the two Ukrainian telegram channels, Resident and Legitimi, long discussions of the arguments that supposedly raged between Zaluzhny and Zelensky about the conduct of the war. Zaluzhny was always represented as the realist, the person who opposed offensives, the person who wanted to consolidate, the person who was worried about the lives of the soldiers, whereas Zelensky was always the one who was prepared to sacrificed the soldiers who insisted that every millimetre of territory must be defended and who always seemed to be pursuing political objectives rather than military ones. Now, the problem with all of that was that always and invariably Zaluzhny carried out Zelensky's orders, despite the fact that, according to these two telegram channels, he was constantly pushing back against them. And there was never any public sign that he and Zelensky were in disagreement with each other. In fact, the official line from Kiev, from the Ukrainian government, was that the two worked well together and were in harmony. Obviously, that wasn't so, but at least publicly, they didn't quarrel. Gnatov, apparently, however, considers that the situation is now so bad that he is left with no choice. He has to tell Zelensky, look, we are going to have to make these decisions. We can't any longer defer to you, because if we do, this disaster that we are in is going to continue just to go on getting worse and worse and worse. And this is the closest that the Ukrainian military appears to me to have come to a repudiation, a rejection of Zelensky's authority, a mutiny, if you like, against his leadership. Because this is what this exchange, to me it seems, amounts to. If Gnatov is saying that he and the general staff are not going to discuss their decisions, and everyone must wait, everyone, apparently including Zelensky himself, must wait to see what the outcome of those decisions is before being told about them. If that is what Gnatov has been actually saying to Zelensky, then basically what he's telling Zelensky is, look, I'm not paying any attention to you anymore. I'm going to run the war in my own way. If you want to try and sack me, do so, but I'm not going anywhere. Well, not quite a coup yet, but when we get into a situation when a soldier tells his commander, speaks to his commander in the way that Gnatov has apparently been talking to Zelensky, forcing to Zelensky, his commander, to argue with him, then that is obviously a sign that things are getting very bad and that we are indeed in a crisis. The big problem that Ukraine, of course, has is that it is short of everything. It is short of men. It is short of machines. It has no air cover. Its artillery is almost invisible in the conflict now, and from what I understand, has been mostly pulled back to the west bank of the Dnieper River. It is no longer in a position to plug the holes in Ukraine's defence lines. I'm going to just make one observation which perhaps highlights the extent of Ukraine's manpower crisis. One of the things that I have noticed is that it is many weeks now, months in fact, since I last heard anything of the 47th Mechanized Brigade of the Ukrainian Army. This brigade used to be considered Ukraine's best brigade. It was created with the assistance of the West in the winter of 2022. The troops were trained, I believe, mostly by American and British instructors. The Germans may have been involved too, but anyway, by Western instructors. It was equipped with the Bradley infantry fighting vehicles and originally with the Leopard 2 tanks, though at some point it also received the American Abrams tanks. And it was the spearhead of Ukraine's summer 2023 counteroffensive, the one that was supposed to break through to the Sea of Azov. And then when that counteroffensive failed, this same brigade became Ukraine's fire brigade. It was sent from one part of the front line to another, constantly closing the gaps whenever the gaps appeared. So it was sent to Kharkiv, to Kursk, to it, as I remember, held positions north and west of Avdeyevka after that town was captured by the Russians in February 2024. There was no place in the war where one didn't hear about it. It's months now since I've heard about it. The last time I heard about the 47th Brigade, Mechanized Brigade, was at the time when the Russians appeared apparently actively conducting an offensive in Sumy region, and the 47th Mechanized Brigade, or parts of it, were sent to Sumy region to plug the holes and to slow down the Russians. Since then, I've heard nothing more about it. Whether this exhausted and shattered brigade has been withdrawn to the rear finally for a refit, I simply don't know. But the fact that there is so little said about it anymore suggests to me that it is in deep crisis and that it is really no longer in any kind of condition to conduct operations anywhere on the battlefronts at this time. So the story of that brigade, it seems to me, points to the larger story that Ukraine is facing at this point in the war. Well, there it is. It's a very difficult situation for Ukraine. I think that Ukraine is at its worst and darkest moment since the war, since the start of the war. It's in a much more critical position than the one it was in at the time of at the start of the war, when the Russian tank columns arrived outside Kiev. At that time, as Larry Johnson has recently pointed out, by the way, on his blog, Sonar 21, the Russians had no real plan and no actual intention of storming Kiev itself. They wanted to push the Ukrainians towards negotiations, and negotiations did take place, and it seemed for a time as if there was going to be an agreement, which was, of course, the Istanbul Agreement, which was initialed in April 2022, but which Ukraine, following the advice or instructions of the West, walked back on. Anyway, I think this is the worst moment for Ukraine. Its army is withering away on the battlefields. The general staff look like they're in semi-open revolt against the country's president, who is Zelensky. My guess is that Zelensky's extraordinary comments of the last couple of days, which I've discussed in recent programs, he's claimed that in Kupiansk, for example, it's the Ukrainians who have the Russians surrounded, not the other way around, were for many Ukrainian officers, including officers of the general staff, essentially the last straw. And, well, as I said, they're now apparently openly pushing back against his authority. The economy is in deep crisis. with money apparently set to run out in March, and fears of hyperinflation beyond that. The only funding plan at the moment is the plan the European Commission came up with a few weeks ago to tap, basically to seize the Russian assets and to hand them over to Ukraine, but to pretend that this has all been done as part of some kind of reparations loan. The Belgian government, however, has rejected that proposal outright. A discussion took place on Friday between the European Commission and the Belgian government, and the Belgian government stood its ground. It's not prepared to incur or risk the enormous financial penalties if this plan proceeds. And the European Commission apparently is now busy warning Western governments that European governments that unless this original plan to use the Russian assets is acted upon, then financially the situation will become desperate. EU states will face ballooning deficits and debt unless they agree to use these frozen Russian assets, at least as collateral. At least that's what they claim. And the alternatives would be either joint borrowing, in other words, euro bonds, which would be deeply unpopular in Germany, as I've discussed, or direct grants, both of which, as apparently according to the Financial Times, even the EU Commission acknowledges, both of which would directly affect national budgets and increase public debt, which is already ballooning across Europe. So there is no full guarantee that more funding for Ukraine will be provided. At least Zelensky cannot assume at this moment that it will. And Ukrainian troops are surrounded in Kupiansk and Pokrovsk, thousands of them, and the Russians are breaking through in Zaporozhye region and are likely, once Pokrovsk and Kupiansk falls, to advance further towards the Dnieper and to encircle the remaining Ukrainian troops in Donbas, in Slovyansk and Kramatorsk. Ukraine's situation has never been worse, and to say it frankly, I think that if trends continue as they are, then at some point within the next couple of months, as the British journalist Roger Boyce said in a recent article in the London Times, it could be that Ukraine will suffer a terminal blow. Anyway, it didn't need to be this way. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has now resurfaced. There was a lot of speculation a couple of days ago about the fact that he didn't attend the Security Council meeting in Moscow, at which Putin solicited opinions from other senior members of the Russian leadership in light of President Trump's comments about the United States resuming nuclear testing. And many people noticed the fact that Lavrov wasn't there, and there were some claims which the Kremlin categorically denied. There were some claims that Lavrov was in disfavor. Well, he clearly isn't in disfavor, and he's given a blockbuster interview to the Russian Novosti news agency, which I will turn to in a moment. One point I would make is that Lavrov himself is not asked in this interview or in another interview that he's given on a more specific subject, which is Russian arms sales, or in various other public comments that he has made. He has made no comment, given no explanation for his absence from that Security Council meeting that took place a few days ago. And I noticed that the journalists who have interviewed him didn't ask him about his absence, which strongly suggests to me that they were told in advance not to ask those sorts of questions. And I am sorry to say that that reinforces my view that the advice I recently received, that the reason for Lavrov's absence from the Security Council meeting was because he had been put in a safe place in case of a Ukrainian or American decapitation strike on the Russian leadership, who all gathered together in one place. It looks to me as if that explanation must have been true. Now, that perhaps gives a sense of how great the global tensions currently are. The Russian leadership no longer believes that it can meet safely and that it has to take precautions by ensuring that one of its most senior members, the Foreign Minister Lavrov, is safe whatever happens in case a decapitation strike takes place. As I said, this is, I think, very alarming news and once again highlights how dangerous the international situation has now become. Anyway, Lavrov discussed various things over the course of this interview, which he gave to Novosti, and he was clearly speaking to Novosti, which is a state-owned news agency, by the way, in Russia. He spoke clearly with the full authority of the Russian leadership, including Putin himself, bearing completely any idea that he might be in any sort of disfavour or political trouble. And Lavrov said many interesting things. And he talked about the frozen assets, the ones that the European Union wants to seize. And he said that it is no longer surprising to see the cynicism with which the European Commission interprets the UN Charter and other norms of international law, including provisions concerning sovereign immunity and the inviolability of central bank assets. Such actions amount to outright deception and theft. It seems that the long dormant instincts of colonialism and piracy have reawakened amongst Europeans. No matter how the scheme for seizing Russian funds is presented, there is no lawful way to carry it out. The confiscation of our gold and foreign currency reserves will not save the United Europe's protégés in Kiev. It is obvious that this regime will be unable to repay its debts or service its loans. There are few within the European Union who are eager to blindly take such steps, which also entails serious reputational risks for the Eurozone as a territory of economic activity. We will respond to any predatory actions accordingly, in accordance with the principle of reciprocity, our national interests, and the need to compensate for the damage caused to us. We hope that Brussels and other Western capitals will still come to their senses and abandon this ill-advised venture. And of course, Lavrov is absolutely right. You cannot create a scheme to make something which is illegal, legal. It cannot be done. As I've discussed in programme after programme now, trying to do this simply highlights the extent of the illegality and your own knowledge of it. But the section of the interview that Lavrov has given to Novosti that, again, attracted me, I noticed most, was one in which he again discussed the failed negotiations between the Russians and the Americans in Alaska. And to reiterate again, Lavrov, in previous interviews, has disclosed that Witkoff came to Moscow at the beginning of August with a proposal. The Russians were interested with the proposal. The Russians then agreed on the basis of that proposal to meet with Trump in Alaska. Putin came to Alaska. Putin went through Witkoff's proposal in front of Witkoff and Trump. He asked whether he had understood the proposal correctly. On being told yes, Putin said that he was prepared to accept it. At which point, Trump pulled back, said that he needed to consult more widely, and that after he spoke to the Europeans and the Ukrainians, then but not before, he would give the Russians the final answer of whether he was prepared to act on his own proposal, the proposal Witkoff had communicated to Putin, which Putin had accepted. I've already discussed in many places now the utter absurdity of that. But anyway, Lavrov has more to say about this today, and it provides us with more information, and it is interesting information. He was asked this question: what is currently the main stumbling block in the negotiations with the United States on a settlement around Ukraine? Where is Russia ready to make concessions, and where is it not? And then Lavrov replied as follows: the understandings on Ukraine reached during the Russia-United States summit in Anchorage, Alaska, on August 15th, were based on the conditions for a fair and lasting settlement that President Putin outlined back in June 2024 during his meeting with the leadership of our ministry. Now, I have said in many places that what was agreed in Alaska was almost certainly based on Putin's June 2024 proposals. In other words, on what I call, and what we on the Durand call, Istanbul Plus. Istanbul Plus being Putin's proposals of June 2024. Based on the original Istanbul Agreement of April 2022, but strengthened from a Russian point of view to take into account what the Russians referred to as the new realities that have been created since April 2022. Well, Lavrov has just confirmed that. So what happened in Alaska, or rather what happened when Witkoff came to Moscow, was that Witkoff told Putin that Trump was, in essence, accepting Istanbul Plus. And then Lavrov goes on to say this: we also took into account the proposals transmitted shortly before the Anchorage meeting by US presidential envoy Steve Witkoff. And that might have involved, as I've discussed previously, ceasefires, temporary ceasefires in Zaporozhye and Kherson region in return for the Ukrainian pullback from Donbass. And then Lavrov goes on to say this: the American side assured us that it would be able to ensure that Zelensky would not obstruct the achievement of peace. Apparently, certain difficulties have arisen in this regard, Moreover, as we understand, Brussels and London are attempting to persuade Washington to abandon its intention to resolve the crisis through political and diplomatic means and to fully engage in efforts to exert military pressure on Russia. In other words, to rejoin the party of war. We are currently awaiting confirmation from the United States that the Anchorage agreements remain in effect. I would emphasize that, despite their essentially compromise nature, we have not abandoned and do not intend to abandon the points that are fundamental to us. The American side is well aware of this. No one disputes the territorial integrity of the Russian Federation or the choice made by the residents of Crimea, Donbass and Novorossiya, who made their historic decision to reunite with their homeland through the referendums in 2014 and 2022. We likewise do not forget the need to eliminate the root causes of the conflict, which we have repeatedly highlighted. So Lavrov has given a lot of information here. He says, in effect, that though the Russians might have been prepared to agree to temporary ceasefires in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, they nonetheless still expect that over time these two territories will be transferred complete back to Russia. Because, as Lavrov says, Russia is making no concessions on the question of the territorial integrity of the Russian Federation. And he refers to Novorossiya, which of course includes Zaporozhye and Kherson region. And he speaks about the historic decision of the residents there to reunite with their homeland as a result of the referendum that took place in September 2022. He also says that Putin also made clear that the root causes of the conflict must be addressed, and that obviously means no NATO entry under any circumstances and full restoration of rights for Russians on the territory of whatever remains of Ukraine. So, to those who worry that Putin made some major concessions to the Americans in Alaska or in his discussions with Witkoff, or to those who perhaps hope that he did, Lavrov has now given the answer. He didn't. He basically stuck to the proposals that he himself, Putin, set out to the Russian Foreign Ministry in June 2024, in other words, to Istanbul Plus. There might have been an agreement for a temporary ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, but from what I can see from this, that would have been just about all. Now, to those in the West who routinely refer to Putin's maximalist demands, who refer to the demands that he set out, the conditions he set out for peace in Ukraine, the conditions he set out on the back in June 2024 to the Foreign Ministry, to Istanbul Plus, as his maximalist demands, who say that the Americans called off the summer meeting in Budapest because the Russians were not retreating from their so-called maximalist demands. I think it's just worth making the point here that these so-called maximalist demands appear to have been the demands which in August of this year, the Americans indicated that they were accepting. So you can work on that, you can think about that as you will. Nothing, perhaps, to my mind, clarifies more completely the extent of the diplomatic debacle that has taken place between Russian and American relations over the last few months than the extraordinary distorted language that has come out of the United States and of the White House since that summit meeting in Alaska. Anyway, that's the first thing to say. Now, the second point comes back to what I was saying about Ukraine's absolutely catastrophic, its critical situation. Because Trump, the Americans, according to Lavrov, apparently assured Putin and the Russians, look, we agree, and we are going to be able to bring Zelensky to heel. We can oblige Zelensky to agree to what we propose, what the two of us together propose. That is what Lavrov is saying. At that time, the Americans assured us, the American side assured us, that it would be able to ensure that Vladimir Zelensky would not obstruct the achievement of peace. And the entire meeting in Alaska, the understanding that Putin and Trump reached in Alaska, appears to have been predicated on that assumption. And it has proved to be completely wrong. All it took was a single meeting between Trump and Zelensky with all of the other European leaders present. The meeting that took place in the Oval Office in Washington, a disastrously ill-conceived meeting. All that it took was that one meeting to cause the Americans to flip completely and to go back on what they said in Alaska and over the course of Witkoff's trip to Moscow a short time before. It is a tragedy for Ukraine that the United States, that the president, did not do as he appears to have told the Russians that he would do in Alaska, which is bring Zelensky on side. Obviously, the United States has the means to do so if it chooses, but clearly President Trump isn't willing to do what needs to be done. He clearly doesn't choose to do it. So the result is that Zelensky has been allowed to continue on his course of utter intransigence, of refusal of any substantive compromise. And, of course, he's had the backing in this of the European leaders. And we see that even the military in Ukraine, who have to deal with the realities of the conflict, not with the fantasies that Zelensky is coming up with all the time, and which his media friends in the West and his government friends in the West never cease repeating. Even the military are now starting to push back. How much better the situation would have been if, after Alaska, Trump had called Zelensky in, told the Europeans to stay away, told Zelensky, this is the end, it's gone as far as it can, we can't continue to support you, the Russians are winning the war, our inventories of weapons are reduced, we can't deplete them further in what is now obviously a doomed enterprise. If you want to go on fighting, you're on your own. Had Trump said that, well, I suspect that Zelensky would have either come round, or much more likely, people in Ukraine and in Europe, other than Zelensky, would have realised that the game was up and it would all have been over. Well, not. No. Trump didn't do that. He failed. Zelensky continued on his way. The Europeans continued to back him. And, well, we see now where we are. Ukraine is going dark. There's likely to be insufficient heating for the wheat for the winter. The economy is close to collapse. Hyperinflation looms. Weapon supplies from the West are reducing. The army is wearing out. And the Russians are besieging Kupiansk and Pokrovsk. I increasingly think that Alaska will be seen when the history of this war is written as Ukraine's last chance. Anyway, that's what I want to say about the conflict in Ukraine. I'm going to say a few further things. There continues to be a deepening political crisis across Europe. In Germany, Chancellor Merz has had meetings with the steel industry, whose production is collapsing. Steel output in Germany is 25% below its 2019 peak and is continuing to fall, as one might expect from someone like Merz. His only solution is to throw subsidies at them. It will be very soon that Germany, by the way, has a debt to GDP ratio well over 100%. And I suspect that it will not be long either before Germany's famous current account surplus becomes a deficit. Just saying. I was reading a long article in the British media, in The Guardian to be precise, about the collapse of the party system in Britain. It is the case that currently, according to one opinion poll, the latest opinion poll, Labour and Conservative in Britain are tied equal at 16%. Reform leads, is the leading party at 32%. And the rising political force in Britain at the moment, which is the Greens, has actually overtaken Labour and Conservative and is now at 17%. And this article, which is an interesting and good article, by the way, gives a lot of interesting and good explanations as to why this has happened. But again, it ignores the elephant in the room, which is, of course, the war, the crisis that the war is causing in the British economy, the crisis it is causing in the British budget. There continues to be this strange practice of omerta in London, refusing to talk about the effect of the war on Britain's and Europe's current deepening economic malaise. Just saying. But I would also like, before I finish this programme, to return to the topic of Venezuela, because there has been another in the brilliant discussions of these global conflicts in which the United States has been involved. There's been another brilliant report by veterans intelligence professionals for Sanity, again strongly advising President Trump against embarking on a military adventure in Venezuela. And it points out all of the great unknowns in such a conflict, the enormous risks if things were to go wrong for the United States, the fact that many of the assumptions that underpin the belief of some people that the operation in Venezuela would be straightforward and easily accomplished look dangerously facile and complacent. It's all there. It shows you again that real, wise, fact-based intelligence analysis by real intelligence professionals still exists and can still be found in the United States. Now, over the last few weeks or so, there have been many rumors that President Trump has, at the last moment, got cold feet and is calling the Venezuelan operation off. I'm still not convinced that this is necessarily so, but if it is, could it just possibly be that he's aware of this report by veterans, intelligence professionals for sanity? I know there are some people in the administration who are aware of VIPs and do pay heed to what they say. Maybe they've drawn his attention to it. I'd like to think so. I don't really believe that that is the case. But if anybody in the US government has been persuaded, and if that has perhaps resulted in this pause, well, that would not just be a very, very good thing, but would be a further cogent reason why we need VIPs. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.